Well, welcome to hour number two of Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for our program, Harriet Williamson and Martha Deal, Henry Frain, is at the controls this morning. In this part of Focus 580, we'll be taking a look at what has been happening over the last couple of years with food prices around the world. And certainly, we have seen some significant increases. The World Bank, in fact, estimates that global food prices have risen 83% in the last 3 years, and it is a trend that many people expect to continue. Just last week, testifying before Congress, the chief economist for the Agriculture Department said that he expects prices for corn and other food commodities to remain at historically high levels at least for the next few years. It's something that affects everyone, but poor people particularly, and that has led in some places around the world to conflict. In fact, the World Bank President Robert Zoellick says that 33 countries are at the risk of food-related upheaval. In this part of the program, we'll try to talk about some of the various factors that have contributed to this increase in price for food. And our guest for the program is Dr. Peter Timmer. He is a non-resident fellow of the Center for Global Development and is now a visiting professor in the program on food security and environment at Stanford University. Prior to joining the Center for Global Development, he was dean of the Graduate School of International Relations and Pacific Studies at the University of California, San Diego. He has also held professorships at Harvard, Cornell, and Stanford. He's joining us this morning by telephone. And as we talk, questions are certainly welcome from people who are listening. All we ask is that people just try to keep their questions, comments brief, but certainly anyone's welcome to call. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, and also toll-free, 800-222-9455. If you're listening over the air around Illinois and Indiana, wherever that signal will travel, use that toll-free line. And, of course, if you're listening on the Internet, as long as you're in the United States, use that toll-free line. Again, 800-222-9455, and locally, 333-9455. Professor Timmer, hello.
Good morning.
Thanks very much for spending some time with us. We appreciate it.
Happy to do it.
Can we just put some numbers on the price increases that we've seen recently just to make it concrete?
Well, let me tell you the ones I know the best.
Yeah.
In the middle of December, rice prices for export out of Thailand were $368 a ton. Yesterday, the Philippines got bids of $1,400 a ton.
Wow.
And that's, so, what, 4 months?
Yeah. Go on. Were you going to mention something else? Or
well,
you just rice, to stay with rice?
Rice is the latest and the hottest of the commodities, but we've been on an upward trend for corn, soybeans, wheat prices for 5 or 6 years now. Wheat was the first one out of the and going up so fast because of the production problems in the drought in Australia, the fungus that started in Africa and is now spreading up into the Middle East, the rust, and so different commodities have slightly different dynamics, but in all of these cases we're seeing a doubling and in some cases a redoubling of prices over the last 2 years.
Yeah. I'd like to see if we can take this apart a little bit and talk about the various factors that contribute to this increase in prices, and perhaps what makes this difficult or complicated is, it seems to me, is that what we've been heading this way for some time now, at least for a few years.
Well, we really hit the low in 2003, and grain prices in particular have been on a pretty steady upward move since 2003, and then they accelerated starting wheat in 2006 and then corn in 2007, and now rice taking off right at the end of 07 into 08.
Well, that's and maybe it's just worth again making that point that what we're talking about, the low point in prices that came in about 2003, that's an historic low. Prices for food had been declining for perhaps, what, a couple of hundred years?
A couple of
to that point.
Years. The downward trend is pretty impressive, where there's upward blips sometimes as long as a decade or two. One of them when Malthus was writing, and again in the 1920s, certainly in 1966, 67, and the world food crisis in 73, 74. So there's upward blips on that downward trend, but it's been a very, very steady downward trend in the real price of food.
And since then, we've seen this steady uptrend for some reasons that we can discuss. That perhaps invites this question, do you think that we would ever see prices again at that low point that they were in 2003? I mean, is that over and we're never going back?
If you had asked me that question a year ago, I would have said, I think we'll probably be able to get back on that trend. I no longer believe that we will ever see those low prices again.
Yeah,
I think this is a historic turning point.
What seems to have happened here is that a number of factors have kicked in over the last few years, and it seems that they layer on top of one another.
Exactly.
So that there is a kind of a cumulative effect. So
Looking at any one thing doesn't look like it's so important. It's the layering and the interaction and the cumulative effect that's driving that.
Right. And so it seems that perhaps depending upon who you ask and what their interests are, and you ask them, well, what's behind this increase in food prices? Well, depending on who you ask and where they're coming from, they may want to highlight one particular factor. So some people are going to say, oh, it's all about demand. Some people are going to say, ah, it's biofuels.
Right.
And some people are going to say, oh, it's those speculators that have come into the market. Well, it's sort of, yes, the answer is yes. It's all of those things.
The answer is yes, and it depends on the commodity that you're looking at and the time period and which one is attracting attention at any given point. There are clearly periods of a couple of weeks where there's no question it was speculative demand that was driving prices. But, you know, they can't do that unless there's an underlying basis for the scarcity. And then they move on to something else, and you know, speculative behavior is no longer driving wheat prices. It's still kind of, the rice market's pretty edgy. So you really have to be in this almost day by day to be seeing what the short run drivers are. But then you step back and you see, exactly as you say, there's these layering of causes, and they've been building for 2 to 3 decades.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about some of these things. We'll start out with rising demand. This is something that a lot of people, I think particularly in the agricultural community, will point to and say, well, what's really going on here is that in the developing world, particularly China is the place now that they point to, is we have rising incomes. And one of the things that we know is that people become wealthier. They think about improving their diet. And for a lot of people, that means they want more protein, and that means they want meat.
Exactly right. And then it's important to sort of actually look at the numbers. I was just this past week at a two-day meeting in Salzburg for the Gates Foundation to talk about the fertilizer situation and where that was going to impact on the food economy. And one of my colleagues made this point, well, you know, the fundamental driver here is the growth in demand in India and China, the upgrading of their diets, partly more food for very poor people, and then increasingly more livestock products, not so much meat in India as milk and eggs, but definitely pork and chicken and beef in China. And the head of the policy unit for the Gates Foundation said, but look at China's trade statistics. They're a small exporter of rice. They don't import very much wheat. They export corn. How can you say that's what's driving the world food crisis? Again, if all of that demand that has grown up over the last 20 years wasn't there, there'd be other things that those resources could be used for, and China would be exporting more or whatever. But the actual numbers themselves do not jump up and say, oh, look, it's India and China. India is a net food exporter. They export rice. They import a little wheat. It's not I list in when I do the layering, I think the underlying growth in demand, not just India, China, the developing world, much of Africa is growing very rapidly now. They want more food. So that underlying demand is providing a base. But my colleagues who specialize more on the production side, I tend to do prices and consumption side. My colleagues on the production side, look, if that's all that was going on in the world was just the growth in demand from developing countries, the productive capacity, the supply side, could meet that at prices that we had seen over the last five to ten years, we would not be seeing this acceleration and certainly not the spike in prices. So whatever else we think of that, it's it's a longer-run trend that is not responsible for the problems we're seeing today.
Let me very quickly introduce again our guest for anyone who might have just tuned in. We're talking with Peter Timmer. He's a non-resident fellow of the Center for Global Development. That's in Washington, D.C. He's now visiting professor in the program on food security and environment at Stanford University. He's also served as dean of the Graduate School of International Relations and Pacific Studies at UC San Diego and has held professorships at Harvard, Cornell, and Stanford. And we're talking about global food prices and what it is that has contributed to the significant increase in price that we have seen over the last couple of years. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Well, let me go on to the next thing that some people will single out, and that's biofuels.
I think that's the next layer on the cake.
This here, and obviously this is not going to affect all commodities because, for example, we were talking earlier about what was going on with rice. Well,
right.
Nobody makes rice into biofuels. This primarily is the issue here, I think, is for corn. To what extent, though, do you think that grains being and other things being channeled into production of biofuels has contributed to higher prices?
Well, here we have to really start thinking about how commodity markets are linked across commodities and across time. You're right. Rice doesn't get produced, doesn't get turned into biofuels. You can make nice rice wine out of it, but that's not its primary purpose. Wheat does not primarily get converted into biofuels, although Europeans use a lot of wheat for livestock feed. Livestock corn is a superb livestock feed. So you begin to start thinking about substitutions. If corn gets expensive, then Europeans feed more wheat rather than corn, especially corn imported from the U.S. What happens to wheat? Wheat prices start to go up. That affected the Indians recently. The reason the Indians withdrew as rice exporters was because the world wheat price was so high. So the price effect got transmitted to rice, even though ultimately the problem was a wheat and even before that a corn problem. So that's what makes this so complicated. Not only do we have these layers kind of intermix with each other across the different commodities.
Well, just for one more second here, we talked earlier about the fact that there is some significant increased demand around the world, China, India particular, but not China, India, for more meat. And so you produce and feed animals, you're going to feed them the grain.
Right. And even India, they're eating a lot more eggs and milk, and that's the same kind of a livestock process.
So, and is there indeed a lot of competition or strain between over corn and have that have a price effect between corn going one way and that's ending up as a biofuel and corn going the other way? And I suppose that you can do biofuel and then you can end up with something you can still feed. So it's not, I'm not sure exactly it's an either or thing.
Well, there's certainly some trade-offs. I just saw an astonishing statistic today from an editorial in an Indian newspaper pointing out that Americans eat five times as much grain as Indians in the form of livestock and ethanol.
Mm-hmm.
We're the big consumer here. It's not the growth in India and China that's driving us. It's our diet. It's European diets. So we have to keep the numbers in perspective. But if Indians and Chinese are going to eat American-style diets, we're going to have a tremendous push on the feed grain side. The interesting thing about corn is it goes either way. Obviously, if you're in Mexico eating tortillas or if you're in Africa eating cornmeal, you're eating corn directly. But in the United States and increasingly now in China, we're using that corn indirectly for livestock feed. And then if you add on top of that the mandated demand for ethanol diversion, roughly a third of the American corn crop now being diverted into ethanol, then you've got a real spark, if you like, that might set off a price price explosion. You're still going to need some other material, some tinder out there. My own personal opinion on this is that the biofuels are making the demand side much, much tighter than it would have been even 2 years ago, and it has contributed, especially in the speculative market, to the expectation that prices can only go up. And so, you know, that's a sure winner if you're a commodity trader.
Well, that, I suppose, gets to this question of can we actually afford to hold to the goals that have been set by the U.S. government for increased ethanol production? Or do we say, well, something's got to give here, and that if we do that, then we're going to have unacceptable runs up in prices for corn, that maybe nobody but the farmers will like that, and that we're going to have to say, you know, maybe we actually can't meet those targets for ethanol production.
Well, my own personal view is that neither the biology nor the economics will sustain the biofuels program. We can't do it. The problem, of course, is that the politics still does sustain it, and in the short run, politics wins. Ultimately, biology and economics are going to win. We cannot do biofuels the way we have currently written the law. We just can't do it.
All right, let's go. We'll talk with a caller here. We have somebody in Urbana ready to go. Line number one. Hello.
Oh, hi. How are you? Mm-hmm. This very important subject. Your guest is very interesting. You were talking earlier about the 1960s and the collapse in prices of food. That's obviously tied into the Green Revolution, correct?
Yes.
And so what you have now is like your layered demands idea, which is actually accurate, where you have competing forces like biofuels now, you have versus the demand from populations. I saw a thing on BBC about a month ago where they interviewed some agricultural minister in Indonesia and said, well, why aren't you growing four crops of rice a year instead of two? And he just sort of looked at the guy and shrugged. He goes, well, it's public policy. We don't grow four crops of rice a year. Maybe we should. And I'm wondering if you would speak to that issue, can the technology like genetically modified foods, which somehow some people don't like, we seem to be forced to like in the United States, whether that can solve this problem or whether maybe the population, you know, this idea that there'll be 9 billion people by 2050, is that even sustainable? I mean, your expertise is far beyond mine, but I'm just wondering if you could speak to that issue.
A couple of important questions going on there. One is the population issue per se. I didn't even put population in as one of the layers of the cake. I mean, clearly the world is different now with 6.5 billion people than it was 30 years ago with 4. And in another 20 or 30 years, if we do get 8 or 9 billion people, that changes the fundamental demand side. As well. So it's down there. I think we have to understand that most of the population growth is people who consume about 150 kilograms of grain a year rather than 1,000 when you're rich. So that's actually not the main thing that, at least in the short run, that we would worry about. Feeding those additional 2 or 3 billion people over the next generation or so is a huge scientific challenge. So that then brings us to your question about the Green Revolution and do we get another Green Revolution. I'll come back at the end and comment about my friend, the Minister of Agriculture in Indonesia. But I said at the beginning that even a couple of years ago, I was pretty optimistic that we had the productive capacity to feed the new population, to support the better diets that people wanted as they got wealthier, and to manage that in a sustainable way. I actually thought that the International Rice Research Institute, the maize and wheat institute in Mexico, that the major, you know, Champaign, Urbana there, the work at the University of Illinois or at Cornell or Purdue or Davis, that the scientific work going on to push out the agricultural frontier showed a lot of promise, and I was pretty optimistic. I think what's troubling is that despite pushing really hard in the last few years, finally we've gotten some increases in funding out of the major donors for this research. It had languished for 2 decades. But that's turned around in the last few years, and you hear the scientists, I know the rice story better than I know the wheat and the corn story, but you hear the rice scientists saying, wait a minute, you know, the rice variety we released in 1965 is still the highest yielding variety we have in our trials. We don't have anything that has higher potential than that. Would genetically modified techniques, you know, gene transfer techniques change that? Yeah, I think it would, but you'd be a decade, at least a decade, from seeing any productivity impact from that. So my sense now is a little more pessimistic, at least over the next decade. I think we're pretty much going to have to make do with the technologies we have. And that means, well, you can close the yield gap. African farmers only get 1.5 tons. If you do it right, you can get 5 or 6. So clearly there's things you can do about this. But Indonesian farmers are actually right up at the frontier. Chinese rice farmers are right up at that frontier. There's virtually nothing they can do to increase yields now until they either add new lands, add additional cropping seasons, or get a new technology, which is just not out there at the moment. So I guess I'd say I'm optimistic for the long haul because I think the productivity potential is pretty great. But we don't have that on the research shelf now, and to some extent that's because we're paying the price of 2 to 3 decades of neglect of agriculture.
Yeah, and that's what the guy basically insinuated, that people, like you were talking about Africa and how they're in, well, I'd say it's incompetence because there's so many social problems there. But I wanted to ask you one other thing, and I know you mentioned this on the side. Around here, there's a lot of this, in the West, there is the whole commodity brokers business where your speculation on crops, and you were saying earlier, like the insinuation in the broker in the commodities business is, oh, this rice will be $2,000 a ton. And how much, I know it's hard for you to, it's hard to understand this, but you don't get like a click of people who say, hey, let's, instead of real estate, let's buy rice.
Yeah.
I'm wondering if that is a part of that, too, and thanks a lot, David, for taking the time. Thank
sure.
you. Bye.
Well, I certainly think that the sharp spike in prices that we've seen over the last 6-8 months has a substantial speculative element to it. You think about, I mean, I follow the futures options markets literature. I used to teach a course on futures markets, so I watch this pretty carefully, and I understand that, you know, having more speculative activity is good for liquidity of the market. This is a healthy sign of a market that's deep and so you can get in and out. You like that liquidity. The only problem with that is if you get sort of new money in from folks who do not understand the dynamics of commodity markets, and they are convinced that there's only one way for prices to go, then all of that money is on the long side. Nobody's taken the short position. And what that means is prices simply have to go up, up, up. And so, yes, you can get really big run-ups driven by hot money.
And I was just reading an interesting article here, and it highlighted, in fact, some ag economists here at the University of Illinois who are looking at this, talking about the fact that they've seen this strange trend here growing recently where the futures prices are running out ahead of the cash price.
We don't converge at the
And they don't converge the way that they should. Yeah.
Exactly. And we saw it happening with corn and soybeans over the last couple of years. Didn't happen in every contract, but my research hypothesis is if you were to go look at the particular contracts that did not converge at the close, there would have been a lot of long, open, speculative, that is, non-commercial interest in those particular contracts. And if you were to run the regression on this, I think you'd see that the ones where you saw the biggest discrepancies were the ones that had been the hottest at some point earlier on, and these folks just didn't exit. We're now seeing it on the Chicago Board of Trade with the rice futures, that there's been a divergence between the cash and the futures markets, and that's because there's so much money pouring into the futures market that the cash market just doesn't catch up. It's a little scary because we've always argued that, well, the reason you allow all this speculative activity in futures markets is that it's good for price formation. It's good for the transparency of the market, and that has to be good for farmers. Now it turns out if farmers aren't getting that price, then the whole argument in defense of futures markets starts to break down. That's a little scary for people.
Yeah. And do you think that now the fact that we've seen now some major investors, when we're talking about things like pension funds and hedge funds.
CalPERS has now started a commodity fund.
Yeah, they're now in commodities that they weren't doing that before. Do you expect that that's something that's temporary, or now are they going to be in there to stay?
Well, my guess is if we can kind of prick the bubbles on, just as we did with tech stocks and then with mortgage, the subprime mortgages, if we prick the bubble on commodity prices, they're going to bail out in a hurry, and you're going to see a pretty sharp move down.
Yeah.
The single biggest thing that would do that, by the way, is if the Fed raised the interest rate and defended the dollar, a lot of the hot money is going to run. They're really being driven by the weak dollar.
And I suppose that is, again, that's another one of these factors that we have to consider in here, and that is the value of the dollar.
The value of the dollar, and that then, you talk about cross-commodity linkages, how corn affects wheat, affects rice. Here we've got the whole macro economy and the trade balance and the Fed actually influencing commodity markets in a very direct way.
We are a little bit past our midpoint. I have other callers we'll get right to, but I would like to introduce again our guest, Peter Timmer. He is currently a non-resident fellow at the Center for Global Development. The center is in Washington, D.C. He himself is now visiting professor in the program on food security and environment at Stanford University. Before joining the Center for Global Development, he was the dean of the Graduate School of International Relations and Pacific Studies at UC San Diego. He's also held professorships at Harvard, Cornell, and Stanford. We're talking about world food prices and the factors that have affected the run-up in prices that we've seen. I know we've been just talking about that now recently, but in a sense, what we're talking about here is the continuation of trends that go back at least a couple of years. Questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Next caller is in Champaign and line two. Hello.
Hi. One thing I haven't heard you address yet is land use. I have a friend who lives in Switzerland, and he said that you Americans amaze me. He said, in Switzerland, we plant crops right up to the edge of the road, and you have this strip by the edge of the road that's barren. Also, they said they'll take the grassy areas between the runways at the airport and plant crops. And so, you know, is that figure into the equation at all, or what? And I'll take the answer off there.
Sure. Land use is clearly fundamental to this because that's where the crops come from. The difference between European intensities and American intensities reflect partly just the opportunity cost of land. The Swiss don't have very much good agricultural land, and so they use what they have very intensively. If you look at the rice fields in Asia, the intensity is really quite overwhelming compared to what you would think of as you look at the U.S. as the wasted land here. But part of that is just the incentive to produce. For the first time ever, as far as I am told, I've got colleagues at the University of California, Davis, saying they are seeing corn being planted in between the almond trees. They've never seen it before. And that's a reflection of the profitability of doing something like that. So I guess the good news is there's actually quite a bit of land available in the U.S. that could be intensified. The bad news is that the environmental folks would like a lot of that to remain out of production as a way of preserving our natural environment.
Well, I seem to remember not all that long ago, I mean, we're talking about decades, when the advice from the Agriculture Department was indeed plant fence row to fence row.
And Earl Butz,
exactly. That's right. Yeah, he was the guy.
And we are now being urged to do that again.
And the reason that then we backed off that kind of recommendation was that, well, yeah, the people did that, and then we had huge surpluses of grain, and it drove the price down.
Exactly. And in some sense, that's how markets work. You know, I mean, you get a shortage, the price goes up, farmers respond, the scientists respond, the fertilizer companies respond, and then you get this surge in agricultural productivity. And that, it's not just the last 30 or 40 years. We've seen that response since the middle of the 18th century, the first agricultural revolution in Great Britain. So it's a long-run response between markets and science and farmers and suppliers that historically, yes, they've been the ups, but historically we've been on that long-run downward trend. I think what's so interesting right now, and I'm actually an economic historian by academic training, and so I've really looked at this historical record in depth. I have a feeling, more and more informed as I get as we go week by week through this this crisis. I'm really convinced now that we're seeing the turning point in the downward price in the real cost of food, and that we're going into an environment where food specifically and natural resources more broadly are going to be scarcer in the future rather than more abundant. And that's going to change how our economies function. It's actually going to change how wealthy we are as people.
Let's talk with some other callers. Next is Belgium, the community, not far away, line number 4. Hello.
Hello. Just a slight comment. To pour grain into a gas tank, people keep saying it's carbon neutral, but it really isn't, because it takes much more carbon to produce the grain and then turn it into fuel than you would save by just going that way. But that's not really where I wanted to talk to you about so much. I want to talk to you about a product and a situation that you haven't mentioned yet, and that's sugar cane. Mm. Sugar cane is being subsidized in the United States to keep the price of sugar extremely high for a small group of individuals. But if you look at sugar cane in some place like Brazil, yep, they use sugar cane to produce the fuel, which it's still not as good as going to hydrogen is, which my idea would be, but it's better than putting grain into the mix and starving people, because you can live without sugar.
Yep.
And I wondered if you might talk a bit about the subsidies to sugar and the relationship between sugar and the rest of the world.
Sure. I mean, first of all, I think your science is just right. All the sort of full cycle analyses of any of the biofuels show that at the very, very best, they're carbon neutral, and virtually all of them and all of the grain-based biofuels have a significant negative impact on long-run carbon emissions. And so whatever we think about self-sufficiency concerns or fuel security concerns in the United States, it is not a green, that is not an environmentally good thing to be doing. And so the biology of this and the atmospherics of it are not very promising. Having said that, there's clearly a range of different kinds of activities, and you can even imagine in certain remote areas where corn-based ethanol might make more sense than shipping in petroleum-based fuels if they're used locally in the car fleet and the tractors and in that environment. So even in the U.S., you can imagine spot in environments where that would work. Sugar is a very efficient converter of solar energy into carbohydrate, which is the whole basis of life on Earth. That's basically what we have to do to reach full sustainability, is to be able to convert solar energy into energy we can use around the clock and on the road. The Brazilians have gotten that technology down pretty well. In established areas where we're not expanding acreage into the rainforest, so in established areas where this is ongoing, the carbon footprint probably is reduced vis-a-vis fossil fuels. But if you try to expand that capacity and it requires expansion into existing rainforest, then the entire carbon footprint story goes away, and you end up putting more carbon into the atmosphere than you're saving with the biofuel. So even very, very efficient sugar cane in Brazil is questionable. The sugar policy in the United States is just insane and has been for 40 or 50 years. It's a very small number of people being protected to to make very high incomes at the expense of American consumers and taxpayers. I don't know how to be any more outraged than I am about it, and have been for a long time. That hasn't changed the law in Congress, but certainly that's what I think most agriculture economists think. That's a really bad policy.
Now, I also might point out that, you know, any place in the world where they do grow grain and they are short on fuel, if they're short on fuel, they never turn it into fuel. They always feed it to the people. You don't see in Africa turning corn into ethanol.
Food is just too valuable in any but the very richest of societies to do anything other than either eat it directly or feed it to your chickens or to your livestock. And that, you know, that's a form of storing or transforming your grain from a surplus harvest to later in the year. That's just a form of storage, and it also raises the quality of your diet if you can do that. But I don't know anywhere in the world that grain is turned into fuel. I do know places where grain is turned into beer or wine, and so it's not as if we don't ferment that stuff in places. But that's for direct human consumption. It's
just
not for cars.
Just quickly, because I have some other questions, sure. I know that there are probably some people who would say biofuel makes sense, but that what we need to do is switch to a different feedstock. They'd say, no, making it out of corn, that doesn't make any sense. Using a perennial grass, now that, then that's something that you can't eat. It doesn't have the same water requirements. And there, some people make the argument, and there, in fact, there are people here doing some research on that, that that actually would make more sense. I wonder what you think about an idea like that.
Well, certainly using a different feedstock that does not compete with food or feed crop production would make sense once we get the technology to convert it efficiently into ethanol, and we get the distribution system for that ethanol so that it can get into our fuel system fairly inexpensively. That means pipelines, not trucks. There's a lot of ifs in that train of thought. I mean, switchgrass sounds good, but, you know, I don't see any commercially viable plants doing that.
Well, let's go on to and talk with somebody else. Next, someone in Jasper County, Hidalgo. This is line number one right here. Hello.
Hey. Yeah, I don't understand how come they're all blaming corn for the price being higher when really the culprit is oil. We don't have enough oil, and on top of that, if you're out here farming, corn may be $6 now, but the price to put that corn crop out, it just went through the ceiling like the price of corn. So if you knock corn back down to $2, then you'll have all the farmers in bankruptcy. It's a thing that's everybody got to work together or something. It's not just one idea that's going to work. It all works against one another or something. What do you say about that?
You're absolutely right to focus on the key problem, which is the high price of petroleum, oil, natural gas, the fossil fuels. The world economy is an energy-driven economy, and with cheap energy, then everything else can be cheap. If you've got really expensive energy, then everything else is going to have to reflect the cost of that energy in production. So it's fuel, it's fertilizer, it's the whole distribution chain that's being driven by high prices of oil. So I do think expensive fossil fuels are the underlying long-run trend. One of the reasons I've gotten so pessimistic is I no longer see us going back to $30 or $40 oil, which I thought we would see 2 years ago or a year ago. I don't even see us going back to $60 a barrel oil, which is how the major oil companies have priced their reserves. It looks like we're in this very high price environment for the foreseeable future, and we have not worked out viable substitutes. Ethanol from corn is not going to be a viable substitute for petroleum. We will need to find a different kind of energy economy. wind, tidal, solar, I mean, whatever it's going to be. But, you know, we've dilly-dallied for 2 decades doing the research to bring the cost of alternative energy down because gasoline was so cheap. We're going to pay for 2 decades until we get the new technologies on stream.
What I don't understand is how they've come about blaming corn for all the problems we got when it's not really the culprit.
Well, I do think Congress mandating that we use corn to make ethanol is part of the problem. It's certainly not part of the solution.
I need to jump in here. I hope the caller will forgive me. We just have about 10 minutes left and have some other callers I want to bring in. And also, maybe one more time, I should introduce our guest, Peter Timmer. He is a non-resident fellow at the Center for Global Development. The center is in Washington, D.C. Peter Timmer is now a visiting professor in the program on food security and environment at Stanford University. He's also served as dean of the Graduate School of International Relations and Pacific Studies at University of California, San Diego, and has held professorships at Harvard, Cornell, and Stanford. And we're talking about world food prices, and questions are welcome. And we have several people here, and maybe about, about 10 minutes left. And we'll try to get everybody in. We'll next go to a caller in Champaign County, and this is line number 3. Hello.
Hi. Corn is oil to some extent, given the current agricultural practice. You can actually monitor how many calories of petroleum goes into every bushel of corn. And until that is addressed, it's going to be a problem. And cellulosic production will displace some land, so it will still have an effect on the cost of food.
Right.
But one thing that you didn't mention, I think should be mentioned, and I know it's controversial, and it's one of the things that's never talked about. People in this country don't know what neoliberalism even means. But the practice of structural adjustment, to a large extent in places, is agricultural policy and affects agriculture. It has many other facets, but you know, a tropical island like Haiti should not be importing food, should not be necessary. But in terms of the deal to get Aristide back in was that they had to buy on to structural adjustment and be a light manufacturing platform, and it sucked all of the farm credits if there were out, and it didn't. So, you know, I think one could argue as to how much that actually is causing the food crisis, but it certainly must be exacerbating, you know, when you don't have the practice of local agriculture to rely on to get over the harder times when you're stuck with the world market on rice rather than having some sorghum down the way, or, you know. So it just seems to me that that's really unspoken, and it shouldn't be, because the NAFTA was basically a neoliberal, you know, adjustment policy for Mexico, and it caused population pressure and the tortilla riots, which were predated this latest round of rioting. So I don't know where you'll come down on that, but
well, let me go straight at it. It seems to me that the donor community broadly, and that's the World Bank, the U.S. as a foreign aid donor and one of the most powerful voices in all of the other donor organizations, not just the World Bank, but the Asian Development Bank and the African Development Bank and on, the donor community basically walked away from support for agriculture in developing countries in the mid-1980s. You just look at the amount of money, both in absolute terms and as a share of total foreign assistance, and this is just the money going in. It does. The policy advice, as you suggest, was you need to get out of agriculture. There's no profit to be made there. Make shoes for export. That's the way your economy is going to develop. They missed the fact that every country in the history of the world that's gotten rich has had an agricultural revolution, increased its productivity as part of or even before their industrial revolutions. And so that historical advice was ignored. We got, I actually agree, I won't call it a neoliberal whatever. I just think it was really bad advice on the part of the donor community. And they had the money and political power to make that stick. I just came from this meeting on fertilizers, where a number of representatives from African countries are still feeling that they got very, very bad advice and were forced to take apart their agricultural support systems as part of structural adjustment. Whatever the merits of individual country policies at the time, when you look back and see, oh, clearly walking away from agriculture was a terrible mistake, and we're really paying for the price now.
Again, I hope the caller will forgive me for going on. Let's go to line number two. This is Urbana. Hello.
Hello. I have a quick comment and then a question. A while back, a caller cited the Swiss practice of planting up to the very margin of the road as being more efficient than our system of setback. And that is not the farmer's choice. It is first a safety feature. Anyone who's driven down a road before, it was became unlawful to plant right up to the edge of the road, knows what it's like to go past 10-foot-high corn at the corner of a road. It's a sure recipe for accidents. It also is disastrous to the environment. That margin of roadside is about the only place where animals can reproduce in our modern agricultural landscape. The removal of hedgerows has certainly increased production, but it has been a disaster again for the environment.
At least for wildlife, yes.
Yes, for wildlife, and I don't think we can ignore that.
Right.
The other is there's another sugar crop, sugar beets.
Yep.
And they were so competitive that they could actually probably have put the sugarcane people out of business at one time. Would they be a possible source of ethanol?
Oh, gosh. Sugar beets, both in Europe and the U.S., have never been able to compete against tropically produced sugar. They're probably competitive against sugar in Florida and Louisiana, but I don't think sugar beets are competitive against sugar from Thailand or the Philippines or Cuba or any of the tropical Brazil, any of the tropical producers. So my guess is if you let the market make that decision, those beet producers would be growing either wheat or rye or a sorghum crop or something other than sugar beets.
And, of course, they'd have the disadvantage that they would still be competitive with the cereal brands.
Yeah, yeah.
You have to grow it on marginal land.
Exactly.
In order to be food friendly.
Yeah.
Well, thank you.
Oh.
Sure.
Let's try one more. Clinton, Iowa, line four. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
First, I'd like to congratulate you, David, and your guests for this balanced, fact-laden presentation of the food energy problem. It seems talk radio has been on a tear for 2 weeks vilifying ethanol and kind of direct linking it to starving children in Africa. So thanks for an intelligent presentation. A couple comments. The first, my understanding is China's middle class is emerging the size of the state of California a year. And I believe you eat far more corn when you eat protein than you do when you eat corn. And I'd like to ask your guest if he knows what the corn hog ratio is.
The corn-hog ratio, about 5 to 1, 6 to 1, depending on the actual feeding technique.
Yes, and I believe it gets higher when you're making a steak.
Oh, 8 to 10 to 1 if you're
yes.
grain finishing your beef.
And so when you bring in these emerging middle classes, it's just not that they're eating more, they're just consuming in a secondary way far more corn than they would back before they emerged into the middle class.
Absolutely. I mean, that's what it means to upgrade the quality of their diet. They're adding animal protein to it, and that's a conversion ratio for eggs. It's about 3 to 1, chickens 4 to 1, and then you go up the scale from there.
Two quick other points. I was involved several years ago in an ethanol plant, and my remembrance was that the ethanol industry's primary focus was to make be a competitive to gasoline, not a green project. That was secondary.
Mm.
And finally, I would like to get the tariffs off of sugar too, as your former caller had mentioned. But I certainly wouldn't want to do that until I took care of the tax breaks and subsidies for big oil. And thanks again for this show.
All right, thank you.
Well, thanks for the comment.
We're at a point where we're essentially going to have to stop, and my apologies, I think I have one more caller I can't take. Let me just ask you, you know, given the fact that now we've talked about a number of things, this is a complex problem. The situation didn't develop just last week or last month or last year. And there are some things that can be controlled here, perhaps, and other things like weather that can't. Given all of that, what do you think that there are anything that we should do differently in terms of ag policy that might ease this, ease the situation maybe a little bit at least?
Can I make one plea for the short run and then
a longer? Yeah.
In the short run, Japan has 1.52 million tons of imported rice that it bought from the United States, Thailand, and Vietnam sitting in its warehouse. It has no intention of feeding that. That rice is not going to go to its own consumers. It's letting the quality deteriorate until they could sell it as livestock feed to their own farmers. That rice could go onto the world market, and it would bring world rice prices down by half, from $1,200 to $600 a ton, almost overnight. The Japanese cannot do that because that's WTO commitment rice, and the U.S. has prohibited the re-export. We need the United States to say, hey, it's okay to re-export that rice. That'll solve a short-run problem. Longer run, we just have to get the agricultural research revitalized. And partly that's just more money for the current labs and people, but we need training programs. This is going to be generations and generations. We need to be making really big investments in raising agricultural productivity.
All right. Well, there we will leave it for now. I'm sure in the future we'll get back to some of these subjects, but there we'll have to leave it with our thanks to our guest, Peter Timmer. He is visiting professor in the program on food security and environment at Stanford University, also now is a non-resident fellow at the Center for Global Development in Washington. And Professor Timmer, thank you very much.
I really enjoyed doing this. So
great.
Hope everybody enjoyed it too.
All right.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you.
Take care. Right. Bye-bye.